Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi. For your free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage. Back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me today we have Michael Snydell.
Good evening.
And Bill Graham.
Woo!
Who probably had to swallow a mouthful of food before he was able to respond.
No. All right. I'm done.
And we are here today to talk about the newest film from director Gore Verbinski that is A Cure for Wellness. For anyone who's listened to this show before and might be wondering, why on earth is Del Shannon's Runaway playing at the beginning of this episode? I can tell you that listeners who have been around this show for a while should have no problem sussing out the reason behind that. And if you are a constant listener of this program and are still experiencing difficulties, I'm honestly a little surprised that you listen to this show. Would either of my esteemed co-hosts like to tell me the import of Del Shannon's Runaway?
I have no idea.
Michael Snydell.
You're really making me think right now. It's a really good song. I like the Del Shannon.
Friday saw the release of the trailer for Terrence Malick's new film, Song to Song. And the trailer featured Del Shannon's Runaway very heavily. So... I am disappointed in both.
I didn't watch that.
It featured two different songs, and I remember sung by like Fassbender.
Yeah, which is also Del Shannon's Runaway.
No, I know, but I didn't immediately know it was Runaway. Well, damn it. All right, fine.
All right. Well, let me remind everyone that you can follow us on Twitter.
That was super successful.
At film. You know what?
Re-record that?
No. I'm going to let everyone know your shame. Somewhere out there is a listener of this show who immediately said, Brian, Terrence Malick's trailer used that song, and I, for one, want that one person to feel vindicated at the expense of everyone else who listens to this podcast.
That's a very Brian move right there.
That's a damn Brian move, and that's why I'm doing it. Violent illness cannot shake me loose that heavily. Twitter, @FilmStageShow, Facebook, search for The Film Stage Show. Find us on iTunes and give us a comment and a rating. We had a 1-star rating that we got a couple weeks ago that I only saw now that just said, silly guys laughing, or no, giggling into the mic. Which is not an incorrect way to categorize this show. So, can't really fault them for that. But we would love to hear some positive reviews, if any are out there. So again, check us out on iTunes and email us podcast@thefilmstage.com. Before we get into everything, I want to give a qualification to this episode. Anyone who heard us on Friday when our roundtable came out, you should know that that was the last time when we recorded that I felt perfectly fine. Following that episode for a period of 7 to 8 hours, Thursday night into Friday morning, I was violently ill and have been slowly struggling my way back to humanity ever since. So if at some point in this episode I appear to have run out of steam or lose my mind, it is because I have had possibly 1 cup's worth of solid food over the last 3 days. So just throwing that out there, and hopefully I don't pass out while recording this.
Cup of solid food is not a great phrase.
A pound of solid food? I don't know.
No, I'm just saying, anytime you say cup and solid food in the same sentence, like, that just doesn't sound appetizing.
Well, guess what else doesn't sound appetizing? Everything that I had to live through for the last 72 hours. But I am here, and I trek on unimpeded. That is a lie. I am very impeded, but I am soldiering on anyway. So, we're going to talk about A Cure for Wellness, but first, let me tell everyone at home that we are brought to you by Mubi. For anyone who is unaware, Mubi is a streaming online cinema unlike any other. They publish on their site a new film every day, and you have 30 days to watch. So that means that you have, at any given point, 30 great films to check out, and you are able to access them via your Roku now, so that's pretty awesome. But you can also use your iOS device or other smart TVs. And Mubi, because of Aki Kaurismäki's film premiering at the Berlinale, they are reviving a recent favorite, Lights in the Dark. And this movie is described as such: walking the thin line between comedy and tragedy, Lights in the Dusk. All right, well, that's just my bad. Lights in the Dusk mixes film noir, Bresson, Jarmusch, and rock music into a unique film all its own. That is indeed a unique sounding film, and one that I fully intend on watching once I have all of my mental faculties back. So, that is Mubi. You can check them out at mubi.com, and if you would like a free 30-day trial, all you have to do is go to mubi.com/filmstage, and you will get a free 30-day trial on us. So again, that is Mubi. New year, no tagline. mubi.com/filmstage. So gentlemen, we have successfully, in scare quotes, gotten through the introduction. Are we now ready to move on to our feature review of Gore Verbinski's A Cure for Wellness?
I guess so.
All right, here is the trailer.
Are you ready to lock up? Then let us begin.
All right. That is the very enigmatic first trailer for A Cure to Wellness. I chose it because I like the way that that man says Mr. Lockhart. And also because, for this particular film, I feel like knowing the least about it as possible is advantageous upon going into the theater. So our feature primary non-spoiler review will be focusing, hopefully, on as little plot as possible.
And we'll probably be pretty short.
Yeah, it's going to be super short, I feel like. Move from on there, we'll go into spoilers and we'll try to dissect the plot. So if you haven't seen the film and you're just looking for an idea of whether or not you should see it, feel free to listen to this non-spoiler section. And if you've seen the film and have thoughts, then you're going to love the spoiler section. So let's begin. Michael Snydell, what are your thoughts on A Cure for Wellness?
Well, A Cure for Wellness is, you know, even speaking in the most broad terms, this is gothic horror. This is like a textbook definition of gothic horror, in the sense of you have a place with a mysterious past. You have characters who have motives that aren't immediately clear. Yet you have a emphasis on decay and this romantic understanding of aging and mortality and all these things. And man, this is going to be hard to talk about without talking about any of the plot. Okay. Broad strokes is I really like this movie, and I know that at least one of my co-hosts is going to has problems with this movie. And the fact of the matter is I can't defend them. This is, without getting into any of the plot, an extremely self-indulgent and oftentimes incoherent film, but it is shot through with such an engrossing sense of visual craft. Gore Verbinski is someone who, you know, even when he doesn't make a great film, he knows how to bring across a scale and atmosphere, and especially cinematographer Bojan Bozelli, who's one of his regular cinematographers. This movie is honestly one of the most gorgeous films I've seen in the last few years. I can be more specific about that, but it has like an ethereal, almost like widescreen aspect to its compositions. And it's just, it's very interesting, and it's at times extremely obvious, but it just gets so demented and so, it commits so completely to what it's trying to do that I almost can't get mad at its jumps in logic because I was having such a damn good time watching it.
All right. Bill Graham, what about yourself?
Blah. I could really do without this film. I think A, it is entirely too long. B, like Michael was mentioning, it is very obvious. It is very self-indulgent in both its length and the pains through which it details each plot and each plot machination. And it just, you could fall asleep halfway through this film, wake up towards the end and be right on page. You just be like, okay. All right. Nothing's changed. All right, cool. He's still going crazy. All right, cool. And that's kind of the whole film is for, I'll get it right, Michael. For where is it? When in 2 hours and 26 minutes, it just keeps chugging along. And it doesn't offer all that much. There is a couple of scenes with some teeth that freak me the fuck out. But beyond that, I think the film is expertly shot. It is beautiful to look at. And I really enjoyed a lot of the editing and the kind of central, tone that it was going for, but boy, does it really falter towards the end for me. And it just did not have any punch for a film that is nearly 2.5 hours long. And, but I will say this, Dane DeHaan is fantastic. And so is Jason Isaacs. Mia Goth doesn't have as much to do, I think. Her kind of role is a little bit one note in a way, and that's perfectly fine. And I think she does well in the role, but definitely DeHaan and Jason Isaacs are the standouts here. But yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I wrote the review for this, so I can't do my usual cool, I'm going to make you all guess what I thought, because my review's been up for 2 weeks. I didn't really like this film that much. Not because it failed to do something, but because what it decided to do, I did not care for. Bill, it's kind of funny, because you said like you could fall asleep in the middle of this movie and then wake up and still be on the same page. I agree in a sense, but what's really happening is you could fall asleep in this movie, and then when you wake up, you're probably in the middle of a dialogue section where someone is just fully explaining everything that has happened so far.
Yeah.
This movie...
Go ahead. Usually when I watch a movie like this, I'm kind of like guessing here and there and kind of like putting the pieces together, and this film was like, hey, you missed that piece, here's that piece. And it was just like handing him to me.
What's even crazier,
she's like, oh, God.
If you want to take that analogy, it's like if someone handed you a puzzle and then withheld the picture that you're supposed to be making as well as numerous pieces. And then every once in a while, it would just hold out a piece to you and be like, oh, by the way, this one goes there. And you're like, but you're not allowed to do that. That's not helping me because you hindered me in the first place. So even when we get into the spoiler section, it's not going to be like an in Inception style. Oh, what did you think this meant? Like, this movie very clearly makes sense as not, I'm not going to say it makes sense. It makes clear what it is doing.
Sure. Yeah.
I just don't like what it's doing. And I think that the way it goes about doing it is faulty, but it's very clear that that's what it wanted to do. This isn't one of those occasions where it felt like, you know, there were reshoots or choppy editing. Like, I feel like storyboard to projector, this thing is as it is meant to be. And I just don't, I don't know, man. That's, it's a pretty weird thing to have to go through.
But before we get too far into spoilers and stuff like that, I do want to mention that Gore Verbinski was attached to a troubled production of a video game. Yeah, a video game called BioShock. And I literally think this is it feels like this is a spiritual successor in a lot of ways to BioShock, where he took a lot of the kind of the mystery and kind of the mental kind of craziness aspect of this and just kind of what is this? Is this based on something?
No.
Okay. So I think and he didn't get a story by, or I'm trying to see one more credit. Oh, okay. Yeah. So story by Gore Verbinski. So I think maybe he even came up with this idea after BioShock failed to launch and had some of the kind of set pieces, because BioShock is very underwater focused. It mm-hmm. focuses a lot on water and mental health and things like that, and experiments and stuff like that. So I think he really kind of was in that mindset that he was going to make that movie. I mean, they were, from what I understand, they were even to the point where they were making sets and stuff like that. They were starting to, and then it just kind of all fell apart. And so I think maybe this is just something that's just kind of stuck with him ever since. And so he went off and made a movie that feels very much akin to BioShock. And it is funny, Michael, that you, as soon as I was mentioning, I didn't even get the title out of my mouth before you were like, BioShock? And so clearly, I think you see kind of a reference to that as well.
I know I've seen a lot of critics mention that, but I think what I would agree with you, which is very much in the same line, is I think that this movie does not feel made from start to finish. It feels crafted around themes and visual ideas more than a totally coherent story.
I was about to say, I knew what you were talking about only because I know that Gore Verbinski was supposed to do BioShock. I didn't see any BioShock in this. Granted, I have played the first BioShock and then BioShock Infinite.
Sure.
Not being great with video games, I don't know how many variations happened in between. But aside from water, no, I don't really see a lot of BioShock in this. Now, what I was going to say is that I don't feel even that there was a central idea that this movie is built around. This movie doesn't appear to be exploring a theme. It kind of does, and for a while I was super interested to see if it would fulfill that and do the thing that I thought it was going to do, but it did not. And I was super disappointed in that because, again, what the movie decides to do is so out of left field and yet so predictable that it kind of flabbergasted me, and I wasn't sure for the longest time how I felt about it on like a real level of experience. And I will say the movie is beautiful. I mean, Michael, you mentioned the cinematography. I mean, it's Gore Verbinski. The guy has an eye. And I loved what he was doing visually, but sooner or later, it really became clear that, like, the visuals weren't informing the story. The story wasn't informing the visuals. It was like walking into a room where two people are having a conversation and just looking around and saying, what's the coolest place to shoot this conversation from? Which is fine now and then, but in a movie like this that is so heavily invested in the visuals and that feels so purposefully made, it becomes a little weird that those visuals don't mean anything at the end of the day. Like, it's not like there's a repetition of spheres or,
well, I don't know,
windows. I mean, it's just kind of like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if this was really symmetrical, or this was, you know, from a really extreme macro on the ground, or this is from like a stuffed deer's eye. You know,
I disagree that it's not. I disagree that those two aren't coalescing around a theme. I think the theme is simplistic, and it could go further. Sorry, this is. I don't know if this is a pointless conversation speaking so abstractly about this, but I don't
deeper,
necessarily
I would
think
like
it's
you to make your point just before we get into spoilers.
My point is that I don't necessarily get the sense that the visuals and story are as disjointed as you two are bringing expressing. I think that they are emphasizing a theme that isn't strong enough, though. Like the main visuals, like the images that stick in my head in this, they relate very specifically back to individual beats in the film and are emphasizing a particular theme that is very obvious and one note. But like that is a theme. You guys can say it's not enough, but it is very specifically about a particular idea that recurs throughout the entire movie.
Okay, I'm gonna be super interested to talk to you about what you think that theme is.
I'm gonna say it's not a huge revelation what I'm going to say, but it is a theme.
Like the movie is so bold in describing everything that happens that I find it odd that I missed the theme, unless I know what it is and I just didn't clock into it as it being a theme, if you know what I mean. Because the movie feels like it's all plot. It's a beautiful machine without a beating heart. So we'll see what happens when we get into that. So yeah, my basic rundown in terms of non-spoiler thoughts. Beautiful. Like, if this were playing on the wall of a really trendy bar, I would think it was a very interesting looking movie. Though that would be horrifying, and I don't know what bar that would be. But yeah, it just it never coalesces. The story and the ideas and the imagery never become a whole. I don't want to say they never become more than the sum of their parts, because I hate that saying. But it truly is a series of disparate things, one of them good, one of them not that good, and the other just like seemingly non-existent to me. Bill, any final thoughts before we move into spoilers?
No.
Okay, Michael, any last words before we move into spoilers?
No.
Okay, so that is Cure for Wellness. It's out in theaters now, and I don't even... Like, my wife really wants to see this movie. I went and saw it at a critics screening so I could write my review, which in retrospect turned out to be a great idea, because there was no way in hell I was going to go see a movie this weekend. And she... When I walk into a room after seeing a screening that she hasn't been in, she can tell just by the way I walk into the house if I enjoyed the movie. And she has been super excited for this movie since the first trailer hit. And she had this joyful look on her face and then deflated when she saw me. And I told her, I was like, you know, if you want to see it, I'm not going to tell you not to. But I don't feel like I would heavily encourage anyone to go see it. So that's where I stand on in terms of recommendations. But let's get into spoilers. So I'm going to...
Brad, I hope you have stuff written down right now.
I don't, and I'm probably going to die trying to do this. So give me one second. Okay. Fortified with the crisp, cool, refreshing sensation of Sprite. This movie...
Not water.
Not water? No. This movie is the greatest anti-water ad. So, the movie... How to even begin? Because there's what the movie is trying to do at first, which is keep the mystery. But what you learn at the end of the day is that there was a count who was in love with his sister, and the villagers didn't like that, so they cut their incestuous spawn out of her stomach, threw it into a cistern beneath their castle, lit the castle on fire, and burned her at the stake, and the brother apparently perished in the fire. But what we learn is that the brother did not. He is Jason Isaac, still alive after so many years, with a real fucked up face and a room full of face-off style face masks. And he is just waiting for this 200-year-old baby to become a woman so that he can impregnate her in a cave. And the cave is on top of the basin that is filled with carnivorous eels. And the people who come to this place are being fed a regimen of water that may or may not accidentally or may or may not be purposefully infested with eel larvae, so that the essence of the eel can be extracted from them out of iron lungs and used.
I fucking love this movie.
in a vial dropper on the tongue to keep these people young, or maybe not keep them young, but just keep them safe from the effects of the eel water. And Dane DeHaan discovers this and rescues the girl, and then his...
Under other pretenses, he's also there.
Yeah,
that are related to other things.
He's there because his... I don't even want to try to explain what's going on in New York. He is a rising star at a financial firm, and he has been discovered to have done fraudulent things that only came to light after he took the place of a man who died of a heart attack, who was best friends with the CEO, who is at a Swiss retreat and is refusing to come back, which sucks because the place is about to merge and there are bad dealings going on that they need to have the CEO there to act as the fall guy for, or else they're either all going to jail.
There's also blackmail.
And or the SEC isn't going to do it. So yeah, they get Dane DeHaan to go because he will be invited.
Hey, don't forget Dane DeHaan's father.
Oh my God, Bill. Okay. And then on top of this, Dane DeHaan's father worked at the same firm and one day jumped off of what appears to be the Brooklyn Bridge because of issues with finances. And Dane is having trouble with this. And his mom is like a little crazy and paints ballerinas. And the ballerinas are in a music box that does a song that is being whistled by this 200-year-old, 15-year-old girl. And I don't even know. But let's say, so the end of the movie is Jason Isaacs loses his face.
You know what this is? This is, they had 2.5 hours of movie and they had to fill it.
Like, I don't think
like that's true,
Bill.
Listen to all that shit that
Bill,
you just explained.
Everything
and I found
I
all
said,
of that entertaining. I never found it to be exposition.
Everything that I just said, Bill, requires like a 4-hour movie. Like I honestly think that just him going and getting caught in this place could have been a good 2.5-hour movie if they didn't just tell you everything. Like, there's a British woman whose sole purpose is to be like his video game guide, who just appears every now and then and says, "Lockhart, I found out some new information. Never mind where, I'm clearly mad and I'm stuck in this asylum and have only the access to like crossword puzzles." But like, I don't.
And all of her crossword puzzles that she's cutting out all have like reasons for existing that are related to the plot.
Yeah,
like everything in there is just like, oh, cure,
well,
and eels and blah 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 blah.
I think
and you're just like, oh my God,
cutting up crosswords and then just writing her own things in, like, I don't
yes I think so.
Yeah, but so I guess what was most frustrating for me was how like openly antagonistic immediately the relationship between Lockhart, played by Dane DeHaan, and Vollmer, played by Jason Isaacs, is. Because there's like never a point at which one believes the other. And so they're constantly just in this game of brinksmanship where Dane is like, oh yeah, I'll do a number of extremely dangerous treatments for no reason. Like, It's just so crazy. And he just keeps finding out.
I mean, early on, he's not doing crazy treatments. I mean, that's a little bit of a misnomer.
How quick does he get into that sensory deprivation tank?
I'm going to say 40 minutes in. That's after something kind of goes wrong. I can't remember what it is, though.
And his first glass of water has, like, an eel nymph in it. Like,
maybe.
There's no slow ratcheting up. There's no, like, everything just starts happening. And so, and like you said, Bill and Mike, who continuously had to remind me of subplots.
We didn't even get to the car accident.
Oh my god, like the deer and the car accident and all the other stuff. And then,
okay,
like,
I'm sorry.
Anyway, so I just want to say how this fucking movie ends. So what happens is he sort of accidentally burns down this place, rescues the girl. The girl brains her father with a shovel. He gets devoured by eels. And then they take her bike and drive away, and he runs into the CEOs of his or not the CEOs, but the board members of his company, who finally, after months, have decided to come and see what's up with this guy. It's not months. It's like maybe a week and a half. But they're like,
which is crazy
in
itself.
Yeah, because he's just gone. And then when he calls them and is like, oh, my God, you'll never believe what's happening. Like, where have you been? And he's like, I'm at the place. They told me they told you. And they're like, we never heard anything. You need to get your ass back here. And he's like, uh-oh. And they're just so furious all the time that they never think about it. And then it's like another 5 days until they show up. And so he's biking away, and they're like, what is happening? Like, are you mad? And he's like, actually, I'm feeling quite well. And then he cycles away. End of movie. So, Michael, what was the theme?
Okay. The theme is literally in the title. It's being well and illness. Every single aspect you just talked about is in relation to his mental condition. Like, that is a theme. I'm not saying it's a good theme, but watching him get well as everyone else gets sick, that is a theme.
I don't agree.
But every okay.
Wait, did you just say he gets well
by the end of the movie? Yes.
Yeah, but okay. I just like
no. Okay, Brian. What I'm saying is every part of that story is in a way about that. Like, that's what it is about. It's not a. That doesn't mean it's complex or anything.
I agree,
like,
that that's what it's doing. I don't know that I agree that that's what it's about. Like, does that make any sense? Like,
no, it does.
That makes sense to me. Yeah.
Early on, I felt like the movie was trying to say something about
capitalism.
Yeah, like about capitalism. Yes. Or modern condition. Sure. Of like there's a guy who's even like, why does anyone even go and take the waters, like, in the 21st century? Which is a solid question. I know that it happens all the time in the old Russian novels I read, and those people always come back feeling great. But so I really did think it was going to be about, like, I thought that there would be a turn. I thought that there would be a moment at which Dane DeHaan really does have to, like, come to the recognition that, like, yeah, the modern condition for most humanity leaves them sick, like, leaves them bad. Like, that this concept we have of wellness, which is like wealth and keeping busy and doing all this other stuff, is like wrong. And I was kind of disappointed that the cure for wellness was eel juice being extracted from crazy witch people. And it's just weird to me. Like, I was ready for this movie to do so many things. I was ready. I shit you not. I was ready for alien invasion narrative. What I wasn't ready for and couldn't accept was that it was this weird story about this count who just wants to fuck his niece daughter. Like,
I mean, this isn't really that much different from something like Shutter Island or Stoner's Asylum. Like, this is in line with the dumb, like, pile of twists that come about in Sanitarium or Haunted House movies.
Okay, but
Well, but this is there's no twist here.
That's
there's
what I was
no twist
say.
At all.
No, there's like 10 twists. Like,
No. Okay.
What?
I want to build off of Bill's point. So like in Shutter Island, you have a very clear narrative that is building and building and building. And then the twist comes. And I'm not going to spoil Shutter Island, but it is something that recontextualizes the reality of the movie and makes you realize what the movie is truly about. Even if just on a personal level, if not a social level. This movie, we never recontextualize Dane DeHaan. We never recontextualize this place. Like, it immediately seems to be a bad place, which it is. And he seems to be an overworked asshole, which he is. But like, there's no twist. There's just random nonsense that just keeps happening, and that's not what a twist is.
I found it so odd that Dane DeHaan's character continuously like tries to upend this place, tries to go against the grain, constantly is being caught, and. Even when he's punished, like the two scene when he how does he escape the dentist there? What the hell just happened? He was in well, handcuffs.
He's in an asylum, so why would they need to kill him or anything? If he's in an asylum, no one's gonna believe.
He literally escaped.
Like I love that.
But the question is, how does he get out of the shackles and head brace that they have him in when the last thing we see is them drilling out his tooth?
And then we see him in his room. That's the next scene.
No, the next scene is him bursting into a police station.
No, the next scene is actually him bursting into the vehicle, into the Bentley. And he's like, go, go, go. And you're where the fuck did you come from?
Film stage show first. Bill Graham correctly corrected me on a plot point that I had forgotten.
Woo! I remember this.
Because I was seven hours ago.
Yeah, I was so hyped up on coffee and just like, what the fuck is going on? And everything just was very linear. It was very progressive, and it was just like la 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 la. So yeah, this is very easy for me to follow.
Can we make a rule that if a movie is easy for Bill to follow, that it has no twists?
Probably.
Even if that twist is as simple as why is it called Kubo in the Two Strings?
Hey, stop that.
Okay. But yeah,
I don't even remember what I was saying.
But he constantly does this thing where he's constantly like punished but not really punished, and then like they let him have free rein again. And he's punished and then they let him have free reign again, and you're just
because he's in an asylum. Like, where is he going to go?
He escapes in this movie no less than three times.
Okay, and he never actually escapes
because he's an imbecile.
Yes,
like
yes, he's not good at escaping, or he's good at half escaping. He is a half-assed planner.
Yeah, it's. It's super.
I don't know, guys.
Man. Like,
I was not bothered by the logic jumps in this because I was never bored. The movie that this reminds me most of, and I think I mentioned this to you, Brian, when I first saw this, on I think the same night as you. This is what I wanted Crimson Peak to be.
That's another movie that I didn't really like. That
I don't.
I don't like. I liked Crimson Peak. Oh man.
Yeah. I don't like Crimson Peak, and I rewatched it today. But I mention that because I think both these films have a lot of similarities, a lot of the same weaknesses and a lot of the same strengths, and also a few of the same plot threads. But my point in mentioning that is that Crimson Peak, not that much happens until the very end. The reason why I was okay with the nonsense of A Cure for Wellness is like, it's not like, you watch him do nothing for a while. Like, this movie is batshit from the first 5 minutes till the end credits. Like, it's not like you're just watching people have exposition conversations. Like, you're seeing insane things like his teeth getting drilled through and eels being force-fed to him.
But what do those eels do to him? Like,
I have no idea.
Michael, this is why I can't get behind what you're saying, because yes, there is a lot of incident in this movie.
I just said, I agree. It doesn't make sense, but I, for some reason, the way that this was paced, the way that it just carried me along, it's like I was just inoculated from logic. Well, you know, I.
What I would like to say.
Shutter Island.
What was that?
Speaking of Shutter Island.
But okay, again, Shutter Island, like, you know, oh, there's a storm, so we can't leave, and there's a mystery that this guy believes he has to solve. He is a federal marshal there to execute a search. Like, and his character makes that an important mission for him, and he, like, refuses to leave because he needs to be there to solve this issue in Shutter Island. In this movie, Dane DeHaan doesn't have a reason to stick around. This guy is, like, gone, and he could just go back to the people in New York and be like, you know what? I don't know what the hell's going on. Like, that place is nuts. I'm done with this. But, like,
but he tries to leave and cannot. Like, I'm still not quite sure why you guys say.
I don't feel like he tries to leave that hard. You know?
Nope.
Like,
nope. He tries also, to uncover it. He tries to like reveal the place, but he doesn't try to actually leave at any point. Not in my estimation.
Yes, he does. Going to the police station is not trying to leave.
That's like the moment when he tries and when you realize, like, oh, the police are not. But, like, he goes to that town and he has a medical file that clearly, like, if you took that medical file, like, to any, like, the U.S. and started throwing around.
How would he get there?
What was that?
How would he get there? I'm confused.
On a train.
He met the driver in that town. He could have been like, brother, you got to get me the fuck out of here. Like,
yeah. At no point does he actually say that.
Yeah.
Like, even when he goes to the police station, he's like, y'all need to uncover this plot. I found this plot. Y'all need to shut this place down. He's not trying to leave. He's like, you guys need to uncover this place. They're doing crazy things up there.
Yeah, but he doesn't even know what he's uncovering. And like I said, like, he gets those eels shoved down his throat, which I was like, ooh, at first, just viscerally, and now saying that out loud and reconjuring the image is not helping me. But and then, like, the next scene, he's like a zombie. And I'm like, oh, they won. That's crazy. I guess these eels are what made all of the other patients, like, turn on him. But then, a scene later, he's back to being Mr. Lockhart, super sleuth, and sort of Batman, and he's trying to save the girl again.
And also, I don't understand what's going on in the end, because he sets the place on fire and clearly is, like, enemy number one. He's off by himself, right? Like, he's not part of the whole ritual that's happening. And all these caretakers are, like, trying to put the place out, but they see him walking up to the front of the entry, and nobody's, like, bashing him over the head and being like, you killed our leader, you son of a bitch.
Right.
Like, nobody.
Oh, wait, they don't.
Well, what Bill is saying is that there appears to be some sort of occult society. And again,
I forgot we didn't mention this.
they were doing a elegant choreographed waltz. while Dr. Strangeface was trying to bang
such
out
a great sequence
goth girl, and oh, her name is actually Mia Goth.
Yes, she is.
Unfortunate coincidence. And what happens is, like, the flames start and they run out, and they see him trying to escape, but, like, they don't turn on him. They're not, like, trying to stop him. They're just trying to put the fire out. Like, I'm not sure what they're getting out of it. I'm not sure what the cop is getting out of it. Like I said, I don't know if the elixir they're taking is making the water safe to drink or making them live forever or what.
The water that they're drinking is killing them.
Right.
But then the liquid that they're getting is what's keeping Mia Goth's character alive.
Right.
And then the pit below is that it's not really even a symbiotic relationship. Then they are feeding the disintegrated bodies, the ones that are so weak, then feeding them to the eels.
Right.
So it's like they're rewarding them for this continued cycle.
But this, okay, but so the elixir only helps to keep you safe from dying from the water.
No, the elixir is No. The elixir is what has somehow kept Mia Goth's character alive for 200
years. A lot of
years.
People are taking the elixir.
Yeah, but everybody else...
No, but they're not taking the elixir, the one that you put on your tongue.
Yeah, they are.
No, they're not, Brian. They're drinking the water.
No.
Okay, he is. Okay, fine. Him. But I'm talking about the average patient does not have that elixir.
Yes, but what I'm wondering, Michael, is why are all those important people taking this?
Because if you knew... Okay, so all the people who are involved then, like police chief, for instance, right. He believes he will live longer. And
Is it actually keeping these people alive longer?
If you take that particular elixir, I believe so. That's okay. What my interpretation was.
That is all I wanted. Because what it seemed to be that you were saying at first is, come to my house, we drink poison, it's okay. Here's an elixir to keep you from dying of poison. And then it's like, well, in that case, maybe I'll just stay home. But if it was, we drink poison, here's an elixir, it'll keep you safe from the poison, also you may live to be 200, then yeah, I could get that.
But the elixir has to be a combination of obviously human essence. I don't know
please,
what the fuck it is.
Please continue
human
speaking.
Essence and eels. I guess that's what makes it say you can live forever.
Okay. I mean, it's just insanity. And again, I don't think that the visuals, and this movie is nothing if not visually sumptuous, I don't think that they inform anything in any way. I don't think that they... It's not like, ooh, change your perspective on the world. It's just like, ooh, this is creepy. So is this shot of you in a deer's eye. You know?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
I mean, I think what it gets across is like this. The word just left my brain. That dichotomy of cleanness and something more sinister below that. I think the way that it keeps going back and forth on that is interesting. And, you know, I mean, you know, I'm not. I'm not going to lift this up as some great piece of storytelling because it's not. It was visceral to me in the same way as something like Neon Demon or Crimson Peak, as we're talking about. It works in such hammerheaded ways, and even the visuals are like a purposefully static.
Yeah.
And
I guess that
I don't know. For me, for some reason, this was just the pure insanity of this. Just the way that insane things happen, like when he's in a deprivation chamber and some character we've never met shows her breast to a man who like masturbates furiously. There's just insane things in this movie where I was just like
blistering sound design during that scene.
Also, God. No, just in general, in terms of effects too, this is a weird transition at this point, but just like I think that Verbinski just knows how to engross you at every turn. Like even things like the crutches, just the sound design of the crutches against the metal doors, mm-hmm. and just how you get a sense of how limited and the lack of mobility he had. Like I just all of these things, I felt it from moment to moment. And yeah, it doesn't I keep repeating this.
Before we get to your thing, I just want to ask one question. It's a very simple question. Did anyone else find it very weird that he wouldn't intuit long before he does that his leg was not actually broken?
Let me ask a counterpoint to that. Why didn't they just fucking break his leg? Why didn't they just go ahead and break his leg? Like, why tell him, hey, you're in a cast. Sorry about that. It's been 3 days. They could have broken his leg all by themselves.
I know, but I think stupid
plot point. Like, it doesn't make any fucking sense.
Bill, to your point, especially since it's a hydrotherapy place, and that is a plaster cast.
Yeah.
Like, that cast has got to be getting wet all the time and would eventually fall off.
Okay, what I would say about that is, that just goes with the overall atmosphere, that the fact that everyone at this place is submitting without are blindly submitting to what doctors are saying. And especially at that, like,
I'm that,
glad that
we're finally
movie,
talking
there's
about
a sense,
the
there's
fact
a sense
that people just blindly submit to what doctors say, because I have some thoughts on vaccines.
Oh, jeez. Oh, no. No, no, no. No.
As
all
a man
right.
who
anyways,
spent,
continuing.
As a man who spent the last 3 days almost dead, I love doctors.
Okay. And you know, I think also at the exact part we're talking about, there is a short period where he starts to believe everything he's being told, even beyond, like, doubt. Like, he believes it completely until he opens up his cast. And that scene, I will agree, is strange when it comes and how it transitions, especially him, you know, ripping his toilet out and thinking that there were going to be eels and things like that. But like, I think what you're talking about in terms of, you know, why didn't they break his leg? Why didn't they just kill him? Or anything like that. Like,
you can't say why don't they just kill him, okay. because then the movie ends. Like no. Duh. So okay.
All right. It's speaking specifically of why didn't they break his leg. Again, I think it's just going along with the theme before logic, or sorry, not the theme of the atmosphere of that place more than the logic. Which I guess obviously you can criticize it for that, but again, that felt of a piece to me.
I get, like, there's certain things that I'm willing to take, and it just, but like you know, you keep saying like things just keep happening and you were engrossed. I felt that way for a while longer than I should have, and the visuals definitely had a part of that. But again, to go back to Shutter Island, like, everything that was happening was a part of this mystery, and you were building the mystery pieces together with the character. And again, in this one, he just felt so much like a piece of plankton in a vast sea of eels, that it was, like, really hard to, like, get on his side and, like, care about what was happening to him. And then just, like, the number of questions that kind of go unanswered, like, they do this whole thing with his dad, and I really thought that was going to lead to something. And then they have Hannah, the girl, singing the song that his mom's music box was doing. And, like, but none of those ever really come to anything. And after a while, it just became frustrating. And then at the end of the day, I was like, okay, it's over now.
And my last little bit of criticism is that scene between her and Jason Isaacs really does not need to be in this fucking movie.
It did feel
horrifying.
Too far. Yeah.
It was fucking horrifying.
Like, you're referring to the assaults?
The near rape. It felt, it was weird enough when Dane DeHaan was having, like, a weird romance with her and brought her to a bar and she was dancing, because this girl looks like she's 14.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes. I don't know if
you know she's married to Shia LaBeouf.
Dear Lord. No, I did not know that.
Oh,
she was apparently an infomaniac.
Yeah. She's really good in that.
Yeah. Which one was she? Which age?
She's the lead. P.
Interesting. I meant, like, was she the one that has sex with Shia LaBeouf in that movie?
No.
A younger version.
Oh, wait, no, I fucked this up, guys. She's not who I'm thinking she is in Nymphomaniac. No, that's Stacey Martin.
Oh, okay. Then never mind.
My mistake.
But anyway, it was just hard to tell how old I was supposed to think she was, because Dane DeHaan clearly thinks that she's, like, late teens, early 20s, because he's like, you've never had a beer before. And I'm like, yeah. She's 14 years old.
She's 14.
No, she's not 14.
She is
23.
But she is in Europe, so, you know, they drink a little bit earlier over there.
I'm just saying, to my eyes, I needed someone to say, "Oh, that's a 22-year-old woman." Like,
yeah.
It was just,
it's going to be really difficult to do that when she's 200 years old.
That's true.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. I have run out of things to say, I think. I'm glad that you liked this, Michael, because 2.5 hours is a long time to put into a movie that you're not going to enjoy.
Hello.
Hello?
No, it's not.
Yeah. Sorry, Bill.
No, right. Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess that's just... that's just the way the cookie crumbles in certain cases.
Oh, no.
It's fun.
There's my food metaphor. Unless plankton counts. No. I honestly don't know.
Yeah. We did talk about eels, too.
What's stupid fucking eels. any final thoughts on this film before we say goodbye? It's strange because for a movie that we have such divergent opinions on, and a movie that is as long as this, and a movie that is as insane in terms of plot as this is going to be one of our shortest episodes.
Yep.
Just because we're like at a standstill where we just have to realize that like there is no reason, God is dead, and people have different tastes.
How long was your Neon Demon episode?
Oh, I don't know. I could look it up. I'll do that while you all say what your final thoughts were.
I don't
it's
have
not
any.
That important.
Well, I mean, I can do it if anyone has any final thoughts. I know that Bill doesn't, but Michael, would you like to make any final arguments
for this
movie?
I think this is very predictable. I think it's an archetypal plot, but I think it's exceptionally done. And I enjoyed myself. It doesn't hold up to scrutiny in terms of storytelling, but it works as a creepy, atmospheric sanitarium movie, and we haven't had a good one of those in a couple years. And yeah, you know, it's got a sense of atmosphere that you don't get that often, and I enjoyed myself.
I in fact in my review I said that I didn't think it worked well as a sanitarium movie. I found that, you know, a sanitarium movie in my eyes, you really need to be in the perspective of a certain character, usually the patient. And I always felt very much on the outside of this movie. Like I always felt like I was sitting back and viewing the movie very, despite all the weird camera work, very exterior like. Mm-hmm. And I never felt like his conflict mentally was being transposed onto the screen. And so I just can't even agree with you saying it's a good Asylum movie. Because, like, again, if you really want to look for a modern-day Asylum film that works, I would say you got to go for Shutter Island.
And I would disagree with that one, because I think the twist in that is utterly terrible.
I think the twist in that is not the best, but when you look back on what's happening, and then the way that it doubles back on itself and kind of fills in the ideas and thoughts that are there... I think that it pulls it off. I think that it makes it work, at least in terms of what the theme is and what it's trying to do. This is the we.
I think the American Horror Story season works better than this.
I don't
that's,
know how.
That's
I feel
13
about
hours.
That. Also,
whatever.
I hated
a fair
that season.
Comparison. I
hate
love
American
that.
Horror
that's
Story
a good
in
season.
General. No, I don't. I hate American Horror Story in general, and that. Season in particular was like not great for me. I did not like that.
Oh, the Angel of Death. Oh man, yeah, there's some crazy shit in that season.
Yes. It also looks like our Neon Demon podcast was also under an hour. Because again,
well, let's with that being said, let's go ahead and wrap this up so we can keep this under an hour.
Because, and I think it's because, like, at a certain point, there is a certain type of film where you just got to go, you know what? I don't know. So, as Bill was saying, to that point, let us wrap up. Let me remind everyone that we are brought to you by Mubi, MUBI.com. Mubi is the curated online streaming cinema where every day their curators select a new film for you to watch and enjoy. You have 30 days to watch before that movie disappears into the ether. The movies that are playing on Mubi currently are all pretty great, and the one that I highlighted earlier was Lights in the Dusk, so make sure to check that out. And you can get a free 30-day trial of Mubi by going to MUBI.com. /film stage. So, gentlemen, let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found between now and the next time. Bill Graham.
You can find me defending my teeth vigorously on Twitter at CableBFG. You can also find me writing about movies on the film stage and freshfiction.tv.
And Michael Snidell.
You can find me on Twitter at Snidell, wondering what horrible things are in the water that I drink every day. And I write things for the film stage and Pace magazine. So just look at my Twitter feed and you'll see new pieces.
All right. You can find me typing out the entire plot of this film chronologically on Twitter, one tweet at a time, at Brian J. Rowan. You can also find me on every other social media site by looking for Brian J. Rowan. And of course, you can find my writing at dearfilm.net and thefilmstage.com. If you would like a written version of my scrambled, rambling thoughts that I wrote before I was violently ill, you can find that on thefilmstage.com. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us, and tune in next time.
Flagpole sitter!
Yeah!